Hello, and welcome to a special edition of our show, Herstory,
on the Rocks,
with Katie
and Allie.
Usually we'd be hanging out, just the two of us, with a couple of cocktails, talking about famous women in history, but sometimes we like to talk to people who are writing about women in history.
We have a very special guest here with us today, Susan Meisner. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
We're so excited to have Susan. She is a USA Today best-selling author whose books have been printed in 18 languages. In addition to being an author, she's also a columnist and writing workshop leader. She's here with us today to talk about her book, Only the Beautiful. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm a California native, but now I live in the beautiful Pacific Northwest. It's a little broody here, but it's so beautiful. It's very conducive to writing. And I'm finally living near the water, which is something I've always wanted to do. So we live near the Puget Sound, and there's trees and woods and ferns. It's very, very beautiful. We're empty nesters, my husband and I. We have kids kind of scattered here and there. We're doing the grandparent thing now, which is so much fun. I love that gig. It's the best ever. And I just love writing books. I kind of came to it a little bit later. I was in my 40s before I wrote my first novel after wanting to write one for like decades. But I'm finally glad that I gave it a shot. It's the lane I should have been in the whole time. And my favorite genre is historical fiction. That's my jam. I like writing it and I like reading it.
Perfect. Well, we're so excited to get into this book, but first we have to talk about the cocktail we made for your book. So this is called Only the Beautiful, and basically you muddle some mint leaves in the bottom of a cocktail shaker, then you add ice, gin, peach schnapps, lemon juice, sweetened lime juice, you shake that all up, you pour it in a glass, and you top it with champagne, and you garnish with fresh mint. So cheers to your book!
That looks delish.
It is delicious.
It's very good. Sometimes our cocktails are not so good.
Mm-hmm.
This one's pretty good.
Yeah, we're not professional cocktail makers. Yeah. Sometimes we just dump things together. But this one's very good. So lucky you.
Yeah.
Okay, so what we always like to do for our listeners is set the scene for the book that you wrote. Can you tell us what time period we are in and what was life like for women during that time?
Yeah, so the time period is, the story begins in 1938, and it winds up in the late 1950s, early 60s. So there was a lot of change for women during those three decades. But when the story opens, it's the late 1930s, and we still had a long way to go as far as women having the same sorts of privileges and responsibilities, all of that, that normally went to men. The character who begins the story is in a particularly vulnerable situation. She's not only female, but she's young and she's orphaned. And she begins the story by telling you that she's pregnant and not married. And so she thinks she's going to a home for unwed mothers because that's what happened back then. And she ends up going to a different place entirely. And we can get into that if you want to know more. But it's a difficult road for her because she also has a sensory anomaly called synesthesia, which we can also talk about. But it puts a target on her back because back then, if you had something that was hereditary and it wasn't understood and you were under state care, a lot of times you were forcibly sterilized without your knowledge or your consent. And so that's the kind of threat she's facing as a very young, impressionable, vulnerable 17-year-old. The other character is a nanny working in Vienna. She's an expat. She's in her 50s, so she's seen a lot in her 50-some years, but she's also taking care of a disabled child in occupied Vienna. And the same sort of thinking that was swirling around in America at this time, which is eugenic thinking, which is that some people are better built genetically than others, was the same sort of philosophy we saw at work. In Nazi-occupied Europe, it was, Hitler's dream to have the master race. And the way he wanted to accomplish it was by annihilating people he didn't like. Mm. And so these two women, their stories are going to merge and converge. There's a lot at stake for both of them, not just women's rights, but really just basic human rights, the right, to your own life and your own decisions. So that's the backdrop of the book.
Perfect. Well, I would love to start off with getting more into synesthesia. So this is, Roseanne's story, correct?
Right.
Yeah. Roseanne's story. She has synesthesia. Can you describe what that is and how that affects her daily life.
Mm-hmm. It's a condition that not a lot of people have. I think it's still less than 1% of the population has it. And basically, and I'm not a doctor of any kind, but basically it is a tangling of the senses in the brain. So like if you have an auditory stimulus, you usually have an auditory response. If there's a sound, you hear it with your ears, and that's the reaction you have. With a synesthete, they might have double reactions. Like they might hear a doorbell and see yellow diamonds in the periphery of their mind. So they have a visual response as well. And that's something the rest of us can't, we don't have. It's hard to envision it. And that's not meant to be a pun. And so every sound also has a color. And not only that, but proper nouns have a color too. So like the month of February has a color. The number 7 has a color. The country we know as Portugal has a color. And for the rest of us, we're like, what does that even mean? But for a synesthete, that's how they see their world is the senses are overlapped in the brain. We understand a lot more about it now than we did in 1938. In 1938, it wasn't understood, other than the fact that it wasn't considered normal and it was hereditary. And that's why it puts a target on her back. Because in the 1910s and 20s and 30s, there was a huge movement in the States called the eugenics movement. Mm-hmm. And anything that was genetic and was seen as an aberration, which this was seen as not good. And the best thing we can do is eradicate it. And the way you do that is you sterilize people who have it.
And as you said earlier, Roseanne kind of assumes that she's going to be going to a home for unwed mothers. But where does she actually go?
She goes to a place that is fictional in my book, but it was a real place in Southern California in this beautiful area that we call wine country in Sonoma Valley. And it was a real place back then. It was called the Sonoma State Home. I fictionalized it, gave it a different name so that I could control everything about it. But it was a real place. And there were several of them in California. California actually led the way with forced sterilizations in state institutions. They sterilized more people than any other state. And for her to imagine that she's going to a home for unwed mothers would not have been out of place for her. But to go to a place like this, this is something she is not prepared for, because it's an institution, what we might call like an insane asylum. Well, we don't really have those anymore. Back then, they were all over the place. And that's pretty much where she's going to.
Yeah. It's also such an interesting location for this, because we've done a lot of stories of eugenics and we talk about it a lot in like the Southern United States, because we like to think of them as backwards and like, of course they would do this. So why was it important for you to set the story in California and in this beautiful location that like you think of a vineyard and you're like, nothing could go wrong there. Like, what was the importance of the location for you?
But you've kind of nailed it right there. It was unexpected. And there's a certain amount of, I guess you could say, literary metaphor at work there. It was a beautiful place. You would not expect something like that to happen in a beautiful place. And there's a lot of overlap in the book with what is pretty and beautiful and what is not wanted and ugly, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that it happened, that this hospital was located in wine country, I thought was kind of the perfect location, because it's so unexpected. And I chose California because of the fact that it, as a whole, that state sterilized more people than any other state. It's also my home state. I was born in California, raised in California, and I wrote the book while living in California. So I kind of felt a sense of ownership of what happened in my own home state. And so it made the choosing of California rather easy.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about Helen. You said that she was an expat, but she's coming back to California from Vienna during World War II. How did being in Austria affect her life?
Yeah, Helen has a unique experience in that she was taking care of a disabled child in Nazi-occupied Vienna. And when I began researching the effects of eugenics on humanity, because that was my main goal, was it appeared to me that the eugenics movement, you just don't hear much about it anymore. It's gone by the wayside. Eugenic The eugenics movement is gone, but eugenic thinking, the way we think about other people, that stays with us from generation to generation, sadly. But the eugenics movement, I didn't know much about. And I was thinking, usually if we've experienced something as a society, we don't want to forget it, especially if it had like pretty profound ramifications. And I thought maybe a book would be one way of keeping it in modern memory. But I didn't know much about it. And when I found out that eugenic thinking was what led the charge with Adolf Hitler and everybody who was complicit in what he wanted to do, the first thing he did was he sterilized people. And the second thing he did before he built one concentration camp, whose terrible names we know, he rounded up disabled children and adults and he killed them. And I that was so shocking to me, and I didn't want to include it in the book because it was so terrible. But on the other hand, this is eugenic thinking at its worst. And it actually happened, too. I felt like all those children deserved to be remembered in some way. I had never heard that this happened. And so she's taking care of a disabled child. That's her role as a nanny. So she's going to be introduced to eugenic thinking at its absolute worst. And when she comes home to California to the vineyard where her brother lived, she's going to find out what happened to that young girl, Roseanne, whom she met several years before. And she's going to see the parallels too. They're so obvious.
Mm-hmm. And does she get any pushback from people that she's trying to talk to about this back in America? Because there's kind of this idea that, like, you know, oh, well, we would never do that, when they were literally actively doing it at the same time. You know, was she trying to talk to people and say this is wrong and getting pushback? Like, what was her experience coming back to America with this kind of new insight?
Yeah, you know, after the war, a lot of the states that had eugenic laws on their books, they started falling off. There were 32 states that had laws that allowed eugenic rulings to take place. And they started dropping off one by one. There were still several states that had eugenic laws on the books by the time Helen gets back. And actually, California had their laws on the books until the late 1960s, early 70s. And I believe it wasn't until the 1990s until North Carolina took their eugenic laws off the books. But I think the World War II and what we saw happening, you know, the pictures that started coming out of the liberation of these camps kind of opened people's eyes up to what eugenic thinking really looks like if you just let it run unfettered. So when she gets back to California and it's, you know, the war has been over for 4 or 5 years or whatever, she's approaching this ideal that this is happening as sort of like a one woman crusader, because it wasn't really that well known. It wasn't like there was a huge promotional agenda with the eugenics movement, especially in state institutions. They were run by the state. These were medical procedures on patients. So there wasn't really a whole lot of public awareness. So she's kind of going at it alone. And I tried to find campaigns that she would have joined or grassroots organizations that she would have come alongside. And I really couldn't find any. And I think it was because it really wasn't that well known. And in the beginning of the book, she's pretty much going at it alone, you know, writing to her legislators and that type of thing, which is how anybody starts something on their own. I think there were some organizations that felt like this is not a good thing, what we're doing, but they didn't have an amplifier. I think there were some in the Catholic Church. There were like a number of Catholic priests and leaders in the Catholic Church in the States that felt like this was not the way to go. But again, they had no way to amplify their objections. And so the movement pretty much went as it went without a whole lot of opposition from anyone.
Yeah, and over the years, Katie and I have done several episodes where the woman this turned out happening to her a lot in the African-American population, the Hispanic population, but also, as you said, in institutions, prisons, asylums. Were there any real women that you came across that you based your characters on?
There was one in particular, and I could not tell her story. Like it could have been a book where I would take this character, this woman, a real person, and fictionalize her story. But I just couldn't do it because it was too sad. Nothing good happened to her. And I felt like I needed to give hope to the readers of my book. So Only the Beautiful, I don't sugarcoat anything. I tell it real, but I'm giving you a fictional character so that I could give you some sort of reaffirmation of hope toward the end of the book. The real person I could have written about might have been Carrie Buck. She was a Virginia teenager when, like my character, she winds up 17 and pregnant, and also because of sexual assault. That's how she ends up pregnant. But this person, Carrie Buck, was living in foster care. Her mother was already in an institution, having been put there as being, quote, feeble-minded. And sexually promiscuous. Feeble-minded was a catch-all term. We don't use that anymore either, but it was a term for anybody who lacked what was considered, you know, above average intelligence, or the type of intelligence that allows you to function as a normal human being in society. And a lot of times people who are feeble-minded just didn't have the same opportunities to excel in school, or maybe they had to quit school, or maybe they were never sent to school. And so they're leading impoverished lives, or they're illiterate, and they could wind up in an institution back then being, quote, feeble-minded. Well, because Carrie's mother was in an institution and Carrie was pregnant, and the foster family probably wanted to protect themselves from prosecution, they said she was sexually promiscuous too and feeble-minded just like her mother. And she was institutionalized. And Virginia wanted to do what California and Illinois and other states were doing, and that is sterilize someone like Carrie so that she would not perpetuate. Now it's her mother, now it's her. She's probably going to have a child that's going to be the same, and there'll just be generations of people like Carrie Buck who are a drain on society. That's how they were looked at. They wanted to sterilize her after her baby was born, but they wanted to make sure they had the constitutional right to do it. So they made sure that Carrie's Buck, her case was appealed at every level. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the justices heard the case with very little defense in Carrie's favor. And they ruled 8-1 that she should be sterilized when her baby was born. That's exactly what happened. And that to me is just too sad of a story. When Carrie was released, because she was released some years later, when you sterilize somebody who can't propagate, then they don't become a drain on society anymore. So they let her out. And she always wanted to marry and have children. She did marry, but she never had another child. And the daughter that she did have was given to that same foster family to care for. And that little girl died in their care, probably from just a childhood illness, but it happened. She died. And that to me was too sad. I mentioned Carrie's story in the book because it's real. It really happened. That Supreme Court case set a precedent for all the states that wanted to do this. It made it feel like it was safe to do it. And it was a story that I didn't want to tell. But I will say that most states have dropped their eugenic laws. And places like California, a formal apology was issued in the 1990s by then Governor Gray Davis for all the people who were sterilized under that program. And not too long ago, I want to say within the last 5 years, there was money set aside by Congress, reparation, really, money to give the victims of the eugenics movement who were sterilized. But no one's been able to claim it because most of them have died and they don't have any heirs.
Right. Yeah, right. That's such a good point. Oh, my God. Yeah. Now, when you're tackling this kind of subject that is so emotional and so difficult, how do you take care of yourself when writing it? Because I can imagine sometimes, like, you just have to step away from the research at some point because we are dealing with historical fiction. So, like, these are real people that this happened to.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, I have to have a moment to kind of just embrace the truth, because if it's terrible but true, what's more important to me than the fact that it was terrible is that it's true. And if it's true and it's being forgotten, I feel a sense of urgency to tell it. So in the end, it becomes more important for me to find a way to tell it than it does to find a way to bear it. And you know, I feel like I probably have to compartmentalize a little bit with this stuff because it is very emotional as a mother, as a woman, as a human being, you know, all of those, it kind of wars against, you know, all of those parts of my nature. But in the end, I feel like I have something I need to say. It's got to be said and I need to say it. And that's, I think that's what ends up propelling me forward in the storytelling was I have to tell it.
So what kinds of conversations, whether it's about body autonomy or the young feminist women now, what kind of conversations do you want to start with this book?
You know, I approach this more as a human rights thing. I know you can drill it down to the rights of women, but it begins for me with the rights of all human beings. I feel like every person has intrinsic worth and we have to recognize it. To say that one person is a better human than another is just, well, it's folly for one thing, and it's terribly unfair. And if that person who says, I'm a better human than you are, and has the power to do something about it, well, that's just downright scary. And that's what we saw happening with Adolf Hitler and his regime, is he had an idea of the perfect human, and it was his idea. And nobody else, nobody who didn't measure up to that deserved to live, was pretty much what he believed. And he had a whole bunch of people who believed that to be true too. And that's when we saw such, you know, such horrific results. And so I think the conversation, if I want there to be a conversation happening, it's the one where we recognize that everybody has value, no matter what their genetic makeup, or if they have 6 fingers on one hand, or if they have synesthesia, or if, you know, it doesn't really matter anatomically how they're put together. If they're human, they're human. And that makes them human, just like you. I think that's the conversation I'd like to have most, if we're going to have one.
Yeah. And obviously, Carrie Buck is a very important person that we've kind of danced around, but we actually haven't done mm-hmm. a full episode on her, which I kind of can't believe at this point. Yeah. but is there another woman who you found during your research of this book, or maybe another book, that you would recommend that we cover that you don't feel like we're talking enough about?
Gosh, what a great question. Gosh, you know, she doesn't figure into this story because she was in Poland, but she was somebody who was a resistor during the Nazi regime. And maybe you've heard of her, Irina Sendler. Have you heard of Irina Sendler?
It sounds familiar.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
She had brown hair, braids.
She does.
And I think, yeah. We haven't covered her yet.
Yeah.
She was like, she got out so many children out of the ghetto, of the Warsaw ghetto, who would have been sent to the camps and exterminated, just hundreds of children. And she was eventually caught and tortured, but she never gave up information about where those children were, because they were all taken out of the ghetto and safely put into Catholic families. They were Jewish children that were safely put into Catholic families. And when those parents, those that survived, got out, they were able to get their children back. And so she was amazing. I think she was just, I can't remember now if she was a nurse. I think she might've been a nurse, a Catholic nurse. And she knew what was going to happen to those children in the Warsaw ghetto if she didn't do anything. Really remarkable what she did.
That's great. So we're so excited to have had you on to talk about this. And this book came out earlier in March.
Yeah, I think the paperback, right?
The paperback came out first.
Yep. Okay.
Awesome. So can you tell everybody where they can find your book, where they can find you, and like your website that has all of your other writing on it so that they can catch up on reading?
Yeah, sure. Well, the book is pretty much available wherever you buy your books. And I always recommend you support your local independent bookstore whenever you can, so that we don't lose our independent bookstores. If you shop online, bookshop.org is a great place to buy books, because they support local independent bookstores. So I encourage you to purchase any book of mine or anyone else on bookshop.org. And you can find me on SusanMeisnerAuthor.com. And on that site, you'll find buttons for my other social media platforms. I'm on Instagram as Susan Meisner Author and on Facebook as Susan Meisner. I do have a newsletter that I put out 6 times a year that if you want to stay up on what I'm writing and reading, I do share a lot about what I'm reading. I would love to have everyone join me on my newsletter distribution list. And yeah, that's me. That's where you can find me.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much again for coming on and telling this story. You know, it's so important to talk about, I don't know, just the other side of war that we kind of forget about over time. So this is such an important book, and we just want to thank you again for coming on.
Thank you for having me. I can't wait to try the cocktail. It sounds so